At least that's what we hope to see as time goes by. And then, too, as I was talking about at the end of the hour yesterday, parenting style changes over time. If we have children over a span of time, we may find that we don't treat the younger children quite the same way. Sometimes people go from autocratic with the older ones to permissive with the younger ones, and that doesn't always turn out well. But over time, our perspective on these things can change with experience, and I've seen parents try and correct previous mistakes with later children, with younger children, and again, sometimes that works out, and sometimes it doesn't work out so well. But we want to try and stick with basic biblical principles of things that we need to teach our children. We need to provide appropriate guidelines for our children, appropriate restraint for our children. Talking to Joanne yesterday about disciplining that little flock that she's got with her, and how they need to respond to her right now. And you know, sometimes a child needs to really respond right now, even when they're little. I mean, it can be a life or death situation. It can be a matter of saying to a child, stop right now, and if they don't stop, they step out into the street in front of a truck. It can really be life or death, whether they listen to their parents, whether they respond appropriately. So we want to train our children to be responsive to our instruction. And we do want to give not only commands, but instruction. We do want parents to be teachers. We do want parents, as time goes by, talked about this a little bit yesterday, to be counselors of their children, to be open to their children's concerns, their children's fears, their children's uncertainties, and to listen to them. The parents need to set the guidelines. And I'm not spending a lot of time on this particular aspect of the topic here, but I have said before, and I'll say again, that when it came to a battle of wills between myself and any of my children, I never let them win. I never let them win a battle of wills. And I think it is appropriate in parenting. That's where autocratic really does come in at whatever age. If you know what's right, if you're just being stubborn about something, all right. My son Joshua had an argument with me one time when he was in high school about wood. He was taking a wood shop class, and he said something about softwood, hardwood. I don't remember what his comment was, but I disagreed with what he said. I said something different than what he said, and I don't remember what my comment was. But he took great delight in showing me that I was wrong. And to this day, he's 33 years old. He still enjoys bringing that up every now and then. The fact that Dad was wrong about that hardwood, softwood question. He enjoys being able to bring that back around. I'm not talking about being stubborn when you're wrong. But when it comes to a battle of wills, from the get-go, parents need, I believe, to lay the groundwork of who's in charge and who makes the family decisions. And as time goes by and as children become more informed and more trustworthy and more responsible, then they get to participate in more of the decision-making process. But still, in a battle of wills, Mom and Dad are the ones who lay the ground rules, who make the decisions, and the children need to learn to accept that and to go along with that. And it really is in their best interest, in the best interest of the whole family. Parental discipline may be imperfect. I readily admit mine is, okay? Parental discipline may be imperfect, but it is still needed. In Hebrews 12, verses 10 and 11, this is right after a section where the writer of Hebrews is telling us, you know what, God disciplines his children just like a father disciplines his children. God does that. He lets us experience suffering and difficulty in our lives. It's a way of helping to shape our characters and make us better people. Hebrews 12, 10 and 11, our fathers disciplined us for a little while, as they thought best. Is anyone in a position to say my parents were always right? My parents were pretty good. They weren't always right. And I wasn't always right. And I haven't known anyone who was always right. They disciplined us for a little while as they thought best. The good intentions, trying to do what's right for the child, but making mistakes along the way too. But God disciplines us for our good. He does know what he's doing. He doesn't make mistakes. He's the perfect father. He disciplines us for our good, that we may share in his holiness. There's a goal to God's discipline, as there is a goal in parental discipline, to make something good out of us. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, And as we talked about yesterday, that's really reciprocal. Children don't like to be disciplined, and most parents don't like to administer discipline. It's a nuisance. It's sometimes embarrassing, especially if you have to do it in front of other people. But it's also very demanding, because effective discipline requires follow-through and consistency, and not forgetting the process that you've started. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful later on. However, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace. You remember, in terms of the family, we talked about it as being a growing thing. And God said, be fruitful and multiply. And that's what we want, is a good harvest within the family as well as within the church, the family of God. We'll talk about that later. It produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. Discipline does make us better people. Discipline in the home, discipline in the body of Christ, discipline in our culture, in our society. We need restraints. We need appropriate training. We need good teaching. And we need to be dedicated to making sure that our children receive that kind of teaching in our homes. Proverbs 23, verses 22 through 25. Solomon wrote, listen to your father who gave you life, and do not despise your mother when she is old. Buy the truth and do not sell it. Get wisdom, discipline, and understanding. The father of a righteous man has great joy. He who has a wise son delights in him. May your father and mother be glad. May she who gave you birth rejoice. So how do you make your parents happy? What makes parents happy? Good kids. That's a way to summarize it. Yeah. Having a righteous man for a son. Having offspring who are righteous. Having offspring who are wise, who show discipline and understanding. That makes happy parents. And boy, there are very few exceptions to that. Parents want to see their children have good character, do what's right, be upright citizens. There are the rare exceptions to that with people who are, you know, out there, weird, strange. But this is by and large a truth that we can embrace. This makes for a happy family. Listening to your father, paying attention to your mother, don't despise your mother when she's old. Having honor and respect, and we're going to be going on into that topic area here shortly. But within the family, favoritism has no place. Name for me a couple of examples we have in Scripture of favoritism within the family. Anybody? Jacob and Esau. Who was the favorite? Okay, they were both the favorite. One was the favorite of the mother, and the other was the favorite of the father. Did that work out really well for them? It led to such a family division that Jacob had to go away for 20 years. You know, he had to leave for 20 years. And he turned out to be a pretty decent guy, and Esau actually turned out to be a pretty decent guy too. But this created conflict in the family. They had to go their separate ways for 20 years. We have other stories, of course. Joseph being the family favorite, how did that work out, that he was his dad's favorite? Yeah, it ended up being a great thing, but only after about 27 years, something like that. Is that how long was he? 17, 13, 7, yeah, 32 years or something like that. 22 years. My math head is not working right at the moment. But again, it created a lot of heartache. It created a lot of sadness, the conflict. Now, Jacob says this was of God. Joseph says this was of God, and he sent me ahead of you to prepare the way. I have a hard time thinking that's the only way that could have been done. God used that, but God often uses difficult circumstances to bring about good things. That doesn't mean it was the only way to get it done. Yeah, he worked through Abraham even when Abraham told lies. But that doesn't mean Abraham needed to tell lies to get to where God wanted him to be. And likewise with a number of other stories that we can... Anyway, we have examples of favoritism within the family. It's never a good thing. It's not a good thing in my family. It's not a good thing in your family. Don't do that. Children, if in a family there are multiple children, if they're all boys, they're still all different. If they're all girls, they're still all different. If they're boys and girls, then yeah, you bet, they're different. Our firstborn son was one thing. Our secondborn son was quite another. He was amazing to try and deal with as he was a child and growing up. Our second son, Thaddeus, Lee Wright used to visit our house, and he called him Smiley because he grinned so much. And now he has a little daughter who's a year and a half old, and she grins just the same way that he did. And she does other things just the same way that he did, too. When he was little, with our first son, Joshua, if you gave him a little slap on the hand, he got the point. He went and did something else. With Thaddeus, you gave him a slap on the hand and he looked at you and did it again. And he would look at you if you had been through the same thing multiple times and he knew you're not supposed to twist this knob, you're not supposed to touch that button, you're not supposed to open this container. He would go over there and he would put his hand on it, he would look at you and grin, just, you know, he's evaluating, is it worth it? And a lot of times he decided it was worth it. And the discipline and the challenges with those two was not the same. You know, it just wasn't the same. But this is a reality. It's not a matter of one's better than another. It's a matter of we're all different from the get-go. And if you pick and choose favorites based on what you like and what you don't like, you're creating real problems for yourself, for your children, for your household, your family. 1 Timothy 5:21, and this is really in the context, it was about the family in the preceding part of 1 Timothy, but this really is in the context of choosing leaders in the church that this is mentioned here. But nevertheless, Paul said to Timothy, I charge you in the sight of God and Christ Jesus and the elect angels to keep these instructions without partiality and do nothing out of favoritism. It won't do in the church or in the home to pick out certain people that you like better than other people and give them more opportunity, more responsibility, whatever it may be. There's no place for favoritism in God's family. Or James 2:1, my brothers, as believers in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ, don't show favoritism. He goes on to a particular example of choosing the better-looking, wealthier person over the poorer, less attractive person. But this principle, don't show favoritism, is really across the board. We're told God doesn't. God doesn't play favorites. Who of his people does he like the best? Well, God sent his son to die for each and every one of us, and he hasn't played favorites, and he won't play favorites, and we wouldn't want him to. Don't play favorites in the home either. It has no place in the church. It has no place in the family. Parents often have to be judges in their children's behalf, settling disputes and helping children resolve problems. And I'm talking about, you know, sometimes there is rivalry between siblings. Sometimes there is conflict between siblings. Sometimes there is he said, she said, and parents have to figure out who did what and who deserves either commendation or discipline. It's a necessary parental role. And sometimes children get in conflicts at school or in conflicts with neighbors, and parents have to be judges who figure out, well, you know, is this a case where I back my child, or is this a case where I let them take the heavy hand of the law, where they really need to deal with the consequences for what they've done? And it's an area that follows directly from the idea of favoritism. We can't afford to show favoritism to our children in ways that shelter them from needful consequences when they do things that are wrong. They need to deal with mistakes that they make. They need to not be sheltered from the mistakes they make. So when I'm talking about favoritism here, I'm not only talking about favoritism within the family itself, but also favoring your family in ways that insulate them from dealing with the real world. Our families need to be able to deal with the real world and resolve problems and need to know the rules and abide by them, not only within the household, but wherever their sphere of activity may be. And any limits they have trouble with, they need to learn. And we were talking a little bit yesterday, just kind of glossing over some of the problems with discipline in the context of the school and the challenges in that area. But if you had schools full of children who were appropriately disciplined, it probably wouldn't be a big problem. If you had schools full of children who were going to face consequences at home whenever they got that referral at school, it probably wouldn't be a very big problem. You know, if parents would back the authorities, the people who have responsibility, and would work with their children to understand the rules and limits and stay within them, then we probably wouldn't have those kinds of discipline problems in the school. It's certainly not to the extent that we sometimes do have. 2 Corinthians, the 12th chapter. Paul said to the Corinthian church, 2 Corinthians 12:14-15, I am ready to visit you for the third time, and I will not be a burden to you, because what I want is not your possessions, but you. I guess there had been some speculation there in Corinth about Paul's motivations. There had been a lot of backbiting and gossipy kind of things said about Paul among the Corinthians by various adversaries there, both within the church and who had come to the church. But Paul reminded them that when he'd been among them, he had worked, he had provided for himself, he had taken donations from other churches, especially from Philippi and some of the churches in Macedonia, and had never taken money from that particular congregation. He had taken money from other churches while he worked there, and he had not taken money from that congregation. They seemed to have a hang-up in this area. And he spent quite a little time in the ninth chapter of 1 Corinthians and in the eighth and ninth chapters of 2 Corinthians talking about questions of support, questions of finances, questions of generosity and giving. So he says, I'm coming, and he reminds them, I don't want what you've got. I'm not after your stuff. I don't want your possessions. But I do want you. I want a strong, loving relationship with you. After all, parents should not have to... turn it upside down. After all, children should not have to save up for their parents, but for their children. And here he is talking about, you know, youngsters should not have to support the family. Now, we could find instances where youngsters really have had to support the family. You know, maybe dad has died, or maybe dad has left, and mom just couldn't make it, and the kids needed to work and contribute. Certainly, circumstances like that do exist, have existed, existed in Paul's day. But as a general principle, parents have a responsibility to provide for their children. Does that mean parents have a responsibility to provide, you know, the best brand names and the latest trends in technology and clothing? Of course not. That's not what he's talking about. That's not what I'm talking about either. But children should not have to save up for their parents, but parents for their children. Parents take on a responsibility in having children. It was a few days ago we were talking about the decision of having children or not having children, but this should enter into that decision. This should enter into the choice of whether to have children, when to have children, how many children to have, that there is a parental responsibility to take care of them, to provide for them. Parents for their children. So I will very gladly spend for you everything I have and expend myself as well. If we love you more, if I love you more, will you love me less? Sometimes parenting kind of feels like that, especially in the teenage years. Sometimes parenting kind of feels like that. The harder I try, the harder it is. You know, the more I put out, the more I sacrifice, and the more I give, the less positive response I get, the more rebellion, the more rejection. Usually that's a temporary thing. If you've been doing your parenting with loving care and diligence all along, usually that's a temporary thing, and time helps get through some of that. There's been a lot of conversation about that kind of relationship change that happens in the teen years and then coming into genuine adulthood and the change in perspective on parents and how they start looking a little better again in that time frame. But Paul is saying here, and appropriately so in comparing himself to a parental role with the Corinthian church, I will spend for you everything I have, and by and large, parents will spend for their children everything they have. I'm going to be talking a little bit about family finances next week, and some of the restraints that we need to have. But we live again in an age, and looking at some of those statistics about people who are unmarried and people who wait longer to get married, there are a lot more young adults living at home now than there were 30 years ago, and sometimes that creates a real burden on parents who have been thinking they were approaching what do you call those years, you know, when you think you're getting ready to stop working and sit back and kind of take it easy, and what do you call that? The golden years, yeah. Except the gold is kind of being doled out and the continuing responsibility there. Well, we are going to talk a little bit about reciprocal responsibilities there. When Paul is saying this about parents for their children, those feelings, those parental feelings, they extend into adulthood. Parents will spend themselves for their children. But children do need to grow up and participate and not take advantage of their parents and not abuse that parental willingness to spend for you everything I have and expend myself as well and to reciprocate with love. And biblically, we're going to have a few verses that address this in a little bit, but biblically, what does love mean in the Scriptures? Well, it doesn't just mean a hug and an expression of affection, does it? Love in the Scriptures, if I love you more, will you love me less? John says to us that love is expressed in what we do, in how we show our care and concern by what we provide for others, what we do for them. But Luke says, Jesus says, as reported in the Gospel of Luke, that parents in general want to do what's right for their children. And I think that would be true of most, if not every single one of the parents that are here. And I think that will be true of most, if not every one of you who are here and will become parents, that parents generally want to do what's right for their children. There are the best of intentions in what fathers and mothers set out to do. Luke 11:11-13, which of you fathers, if your son asks for a fish, will give him a snake instead? Now, some of you might think that'd be a funny thing to do, you know. But he's talking about the reality of a desire and a need, and you have it in your power to provide what's wanted or what's needed. Or if he asks for an egg, give him a scorpion. If you then, though you are evil, which reflects back on what's wrong with the family, you know, sin is a fact in the family. If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give the Holy Spirit to those who ask him? You know, there are people who, no matter how many dependents they have, will always put themselves first. There are people who will spend the family food money on their own recreation, and then, you know, you hope the family is able to somehow scrape by. There are people who have addictions, and they deprive their families and because of their addictions. But the premise that is set before us here is that fathers, parents, want to do what's right for their families. That certainly is the God-given role, the God-given responsibility, that we put the needs of our children, those things that our children can genuinely make use of, are the things that we want to provide, the things that we want to do. During the growing years, especially during the growing years, parents are responsible for providing what their children need for health and well-being, both physical and spiritual. Providing for children also sometimes means being an advocate for them, a spokesperson to stand up for them. And I actually kind of said that back in the context of the role as a judge, that sometimes when you have to determine right, wrong, who did what, that sometimes the parent has a role as a spokesperson standing up for them, interceding for them. And sometimes the parent has a role of an enforcer and being sure that appropriate consequences are meted out. In Matthew 15, instance of a woman who was a spokesperson for her child, it's a very interesting story, and a lot can be said about it. I'm not going to say much about it, but it's a story of Jesus traveling outside of Israel, the only time that we really know of that he traveled outside of Israel. He went to the area of Phoenicia, up around Tyre and Sidon. And in Matthew 15:21-28, leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon. A Canaanite woman from that vicinity came to him, crying out, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me." Well, she's a Canaanite, she's not an Israelite, but she knows about the teachings of the Messiah, who the Messiah is. She knows about the teachings of the Old Testament. "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is suffering terribly from demon possession." Jesus did not answer a word. So his disciples came to him and urged him, "Send her away, for she keeps crying out after us." He answered, "I was only sent to the lost sheep of Israel." Well, it's kind of funny that he doesn't answer her, he answers them, but the answer is pertinent to her rather than to them. They say, "Send her away," and he doesn't respond to that. He really is responding to what she's been saying that he had been ignoring up until that time. "I was only sent to the lost sheep of Israel." The woman came and knelt before him. She's begging, she's pleading with him. "Lord, help me," she said. He replied, "It's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs." And by children here, he's talking about the people of Israel, the people of Judah and Galilee that he had been ministering to. "It's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs." So he's not very complimentary of her or her daughter, you know, calling her a dog, calling her daughter a dog. This is a very uncomfortable kind of confrontation that's taking place here. And she says, "Yes, Lord." "Yes, Lord," she said. And this is one of those cases where there was reference made to, you know, if you could hear the tone of voice, if you could see the facial expression, what would we have heard in Jesus' tone of voice there? What would we have seen in Jesus' facial expression there? Was he stern? Was he speaking meanly? Or was he smiling? Was he speaking with a tone in his voice that gave her a little hope that the words didn't get? I don't know. I don't know just exactly what was going on there with the way he was talking to her. All I have is the words that he said. But she responded to it. "Yes, Lord," she said. "But even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." He's regurgitating a kind of an attitude that was common among his people toward the Gentiles. But she went past that, and she appeals to him. And she doesn't even deny. She doesn't argue with the attitude. She doesn't argue with the labels and all those things. She just says, "I've got a problem here, and I need an answer to this problem." And so, "Yes, Lord, but even the dogs get the crumbs that fall from their master's table." And some dogs are really aggressive about that, too. Then Jesus answered, "Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted." And her daughter was healed from that very hour. This woman wasn't looking for anything for herself, and she's not the only instance we have of something like this, of people coming to Jesus in behalf of someone else. But she was being a spokesperson for her child. Her child couldn't defend herself, couldn't represent herself, couldn't stand up for herself. Not only was she young, but she was demon-possessed, and it was impossible for her to get this resolution on her own. She had to have somebody to stand up for her, and it's a parent's responsibility to do that for their children, to stand up for them when they can't stand up for themselves, to be their advocates, their representatives, to go and stand in their place to make sure that they get the best, that they get what they truly deserve. Now, in thinking about these relationships of parents and children, I've mostly been talking about the parental side of it. I want to spend a little while talking about the children's side of it. Honor your father and mother. Where do we find that?
Ephesians.
We find it in Ephesians. Where else do we find it? We find it in the 20th chapter of Exodus, which is where we have what? The Ten Commandments. Also in the 5th chapter of Deuteronomy, where we have the Ten Commandments. And it's reiterated in other places in the Scripture. When Paul quotes this in the 6th chapter of Ephesians, he quotes it from the law as given there at Mount Sinai, as given in the 20th chapter of Exodus. And he says, honor your father and mother. He says, this is the first commandment with a promise. What was the promise? Honor your father and mother, what? That it may go well with you and you may live long in the land or live long on the earth. Okay. So there was a promise there that all youngsters who grew up and became adults and honored their parents would live long lives, right? No, that's not a promise of that nature. But it is the idea that your life is going to be blessed, that you're going to be a better person and generally do better in life. And as a generality, it's not a specific truth that every person who honors their parents is going to have a long life, but it is a general truth that people who honor their parents do have longer, better, healthier lives. There is a lot connected, and this is really a large topic that I'm going to do a pretty small treatment of, but there is a lot connected to the idea of honoring your parents, of having respect for authority, and it can tangle up everything in your life when you don't. It can mess up relationships at every level in your life when you don't learn to have respect for the authority figure, for the parental role models that you have had, even if as role models they were failures. This doesn't say honor your parents if they were good parents, and I really think there's a need to honor your parents even when they weren't very good parents. That this is an aspect of coming to terms with authority, and who's the great father and authority that we all have to deal with? Well, it's God himself that we all have to ultimately deal with in terms of power and authority and parenting, our Father on high. So Ephesians 6, verses 1 through 4, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, this first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may live long in the land. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Now that bit about that it may go well with you, that you may live long in the land, I said it's a generality, but it's a generality that certainly applies to cultures. We're going to come across a verse in a while that speaks to the idea that this is a great failing in a society when it becomes acceptable for children to be disobedient to their parents. That this is a sign of a society that's going not just down the slope, but down the tubes. When children are disobedient to parents, and that's no big deal. That's just normal and acceptable. So this is that kind of promise that has to do with a whole people, with a whole nation, and highly to be desired. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And that's the first time I brought that fourth verse up in this conversation about the discipline and so forth. What are ways that parents might, as he says here, provoke their children to anger or to wrath? How's that happen? Well, it can happen through being too harsh, can't it? It can happen through being too trigger happy, responding before you really know what's going on. But I think one of the major, and there are lots of other ways too, of course, but I think one of the major ways that it can happen is by being inconsistent. There's nothing more aggravating than not really knowing where you stand. I do this one time and I got slapped. I do it the next time and they don't seem to want to bother with me and they just ignore it. You know, they Inconsistency, I think, is probably one of the biggest failures in parenting, one of the biggest failures in discipline, that leads to anger, wrath, dissatisfaction, that leads to aggravation, when children just really aren't that sure what the real standards are. Because one day this is a source of an outburst of anger, and another day there's a word of chastisement, and that's it, and there's no real response to it at all. But parents, fathers in particular, as singled out here, but parents in general need to be mindful of how their children are responding to their discipline, of how they're responding to their instruction. Again, no two children are quite the same, and we need to pay attention to what works and then be consistent about that in dealing with our children. Coming back to the children's side of this, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. I didn't stop doing that when I became an adult. The things that my parents taught me as a child, remember back there when Solomon said, my dad said, do what we tell you and do it all your life? Well, I'm still living in obedience to my parents. I'm still living in obedience to the things that they instructed me, the commands that they gave me, and as well, as much as I can, the goals and ideals that they had in mind for me. Obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. If you are in a position, and we'll talk about that also, where you have to make distinction between what ungodly parents desire and what God desires, you know, then you make distinction and you choose to do what God desires. But by and large, the obedience to parents in the Lord, in all areas where they are in harmony with the teachings of God and where we are wanting to please the Lord, we keep on obeying our parents. They don't, you know, my dad hadn't come up with any new rules for me in quite a while. And, you know, you come to a place where that's no longer really the case. But I still am in obedience to my parents in the way that I live my life, in the way I take care of business. Honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise. Paul is really highlighting by saying that, highlighting how important this commandment is, how important the commandment to honor your parents really is in our life choices as we go along. Back in Proverbs chapter 30, verse 17, the proverb says, the eye that mocks a father, well, you see, this isn't even about a verbal mockery. It's about that look. Have you ever seen that look? Most of us have probably seen that look, maybe practiced it. The eye that mocks a father, that scorns obedience to a mother, will be pecked out by the ravens of the valley, will be eaten by the vultures. Well, if that were literally true, there'd be a lot of blind young people running around. Well, there'd be a lot of blind old people hanging around too, because been there, done that. Watch your attitude, this proverb is saying. Watch your attitude. Don't deride your parents, not even, you know, without a word, not even by that look, not even by that attitude that you don't verbalize, because it will have terrible consequences in your life. You have a raven come and peck your eyes out, but it will have terrible consequences in disrespect if you persist in rebelliousness against your father, against your mother, if you scorn obedience to your mother. This is what Paul says in Romans 1, 28 through 31, where he's talking about the downslide of a culture going down the tubes apart from God. And this starts in the 18th verse, but I'm just going to pick it up in verse 28. Furthermore, since they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, so okay, we've gotten away from God, he gave them over to a depraved mind to do what ought not to be done. And then he talks about depravity in various forms, including all kinds of sexual sin. They have become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They're full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. These are awful things that have to do with the interaction of people with each other, the treatment of people as commodities, the ways in which people consume other people on their appetites, and it's all about me, me, me. You know, you climb the ladder of success on the backs of others and step on the fingers of anybody that gets in your way. Full of envy, murder, strife, death, deceit, and malice. They are gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. How'd that end up at the bottom of that list? How did that end up as kind of like, you know, this is like the final straw? This is the ultimate expression of the degradation that has occurred here. They disobey their parents. Well, again, when respect for parents breaks down, it's a good sign that the culture itself is breaking down, that the discipline of the whole culture is at risk, that you can't expect discipline in any area. Can you turn your backs on people and they won't do anything? You know, can you trust them? Can you rely on people in any area? When they had, was it Lehman Brothers or which one was it? I forget. I lose track of these things. That when they were having congressional hearings, doesn't seem like it was Lehman Brothers, but where they were having congressional hearings and these executives were sitting there and being challenged by the congressmen about their handling of funds and how they had basically misrepresented funds to their clients and sold them junk that they were going to lose money on, but they made a lot of money on it. And the guys that were sitting there taking the questions from the congressmen were basically saying, yeah, you know, what's the big deal? We made a lot of money. What was wrong? They didn't break any laws. So, you know, this is the level of profiteering that a lot of people in positions of power and influence have to do. Is, you know, if it's not illegal, then what's the big deal? If the law doesn't say it was a crime, then what's the big deal? And that's the kind of culture, the kind of society that comes from, yeah, this last thing here, if disobedience to parents, if discipline within the home, if respect within the home, if that breaks down, then we've pretty much lost it everywhere. Because if you don't have respect in that most basic of human relationships, if you don't have obedience and cooperation in that most basic of human relationships, then how can you expect anybody else? How can anyone expect anyone to do what's right, to have respect for law, to have obedience to authority figures? How can you expect anyone not to do that most basic kind of selfish thing of, you know, whatever I can get away with, whatever seems to be in my best interest? Disobeying parents is pictured as a big sign of a sick culture. So we're supposed to honor father and mother. Well, how do you honor father and mother? Again, you know, if your parents are good, godly people, then it may come fairly natural, but there are some areas that need to have our attention. Proverbs chapter 3, verses 9 and 10, honor the Lord with your wealth and with the first fruits of your produce. Then your barns will be filled with plenty, and your vats will be bursting with wine. Parents aren't mentioned there at all. Children, parents aren't mentioned there. So why did I pick that passage? What's the passage instructing people to do?
In general,
okay. To do what?
Honor.
Okay. If this is a way to honor the Lord, and it is a way to honor the Lord, what's the way? With what? With your wealth, with your produce, okay. To use your income to honor the Lord, all right? So what's a way of honoring your parents?
Taking care of them.
Yeah, using your resources to help them. Sometimes in the course of life, things turn around over the course of the years, over the course of time. And being willing to make financial sacrifices for your parents. That's a way of honoring God, making financial sacrifices. That's a way of honoring, really, lots of different things. But it certainly is a way of honoring parents, is to make financial sacrifices for them. In Matthew, the 15th chapter, Jesus took some of his people to task because they were standing that on his head. They were looking for escape clauses from honoring their father and mother. Matthew 15, verses 4 through 6, God said, honor your father and mother. And anyone who curses his father or mother must be put to death. But you say that if a man says to his father or mother, whatever help you might otherwise have received from me is a gift devoted to God, he's not to honor his father and mother with it. Thus you nullify the word of God for the sake of your tradition. What were people doing? They were taking their wealth, they were taking their possessions, and they were saying, this is dedicated to God. Does that mean that they were impoverishing themselves? No, not really. They were kind of like setting up an estate or a trust, you know, and they were setting up a scenario where, you know, when I die, this is going to go to the temple. Well, since it's dedicated to God, I can't touch it. I can't use it. I do agree with the idea that was expressed the other day. I think it was Grant Riggins when he was talking about money and finances, and he said the Lord's money. What's the Lord's money? Well, he owns the cattle on 1,000 hills, as David notes in the Psalms. It's all his. And what's in your wallet is his just as much as what's in the church treasury. And that would have been true for the Israelites too. They had that same kind of message. It was in their Psalms. It was in their law that teaching was given. And the idea of dedicating it to God, well, now it's the Lord's, and we can't use it to help mom and dad. That's the kind of escape clause that they were producing for themselves. And Jesus said, that's not honoring your father and mother. You're disobeying the command of God. You set up a dummy, a blind, to obfuscate the fact that you are not honoring your father and your mother. You're nullifying the word of God. This is one way in which children over the years may honor their father and mother, is to help them with what they need, to make sure that they don't lack, that they don't do without. Proverbs 23, verse 22, how do you honor? Honor. Listen to your father who gave you life, and do not despise your mother when she's old. Again, this is one of the ways that we honor our parents, is by living up to the things that they have taught us, by being the kind of person they would want us to be, assuming that they had any kind of decent goals and expectations at all. And for all of us who have or had Christian parents, that certainly would be the case. But this is one of the ways in which we show honor, is by our way of life as we age, as we grow, as we age. Father who gave you life. Do not despise your mother when she is old. That, again, goes to the idea of caring for, but also living in a way that is appropriate and admirable. Don't do things that your parents would be ashamed of as the years go by. Proverbs 10:1. The Proverbs of Solomon, a wise son brings joy to his father, but a foolish son grief to his mother. Is that always true? Okay, sometimes dads feel competitive with their sons, and that's really a bad thing. But sometimes, you know, I used to play a lot of competitive games. Isn't that right, Keith? I used to play a lot of competitive games, and I can be as competitive, well, I can be as competitive as the next guy, or way more than that. I can be very competitive. And as my sons grew up, they wanted to play those games, and I lost interest in playing those games because I really did not enjoy competing with my sons. I was perfectly happy for them to compete with each other, but I really did not enjoy competing with my sons. It was no fun to beat them, and it was really no fun to lose to them. You know, neither one of those was really a very desirable outcome. I never really felt very good about being in a competitive situation with my children. Now, I liked games where we would play cooperatively against, you know, a computer opponent or something like that. Those kind of games were kind of fun. But I never really enjoyed very much being competitive with my sons. And that's an area where you do kind of have to be wary. Because fathers should want their children to excel and to do better than they do. Parents should want their children to excel, to do better than they do. And this proverb addresses that idea. A wise son brings joy to his father, but a foolish son, grief to his mother. Fathers and mothers should, and generally do, want to see their children do well. How do you honor your parents? Well, that's a way to honor your parents and to bring them pleasure and joy as the years go by. But this is a way of honoring your parents, is to live well, to live wisely, and not to show foolish choices in your life decisions. Proverbs 15 and 20, a wise son brings joy to his father, a foolish man despises his mother. Very much the same kind of idea, recapitulating the same idea, that this is an important way to honor your parents. Now, if your parents were not ideal people, if your parents were far, far from ideal people, if you had parents that were abusive or selfish or harsh or any of those things, this is still a way to honor them by being the best person that you can be, by demonstrating wisdom and godliness in your life. This is a way of honoring your parents, even if your parents were not particularly admirable themselves. Solomon said, a wise son brings joy to his father, a foolish son makes his mother miserable. Jesus says, a wise man built his house upon the rock. And what was the rock he was talking about there? Himself, the words he was teaching. If you take these words of mine and put them into practice, that's like a wise man building his house on a rock. If you don't practice what I have taught you, that's like a foolish man building his house on the sand. So if practicing what Jesus says is a display of wisdom, and not doing what Jesus says is a display of folly, then what's a good way to honor your parents? Anyone? Following Jesus Christ. There is no better way, and I'm not being silly about this, there is no better way to honor your parents than by being a godly follower of Jesus Christ, by putting the teachings of Jesus into practice, no matter who your parents were, no matter what their basis was in their life. There is no better way to honor your parents. They expected it, anticipated it, prepared for it, wanted it or not. This is a legitimate, this is a beautiful way to honor your parents. There is the opposite of honor. It was referred to in both of those previous passages from Proverbs. To have a fool for a son brings grief. There's no joy for the father of a fool. Don't be a fool. A foolish son brings grief to his father and bitterness to the one who bore him. In the psalm, there is a reference to a fool. What is the fool described as, or what's the characteristic of a fool addressed in the psalm that's very well known? What does the fool do? What does he say in his heart? He says in his heart, there's no God. And what David's describing there was a man like Abigail's first husband, whose name meant fool. And he was a man who really didn't care about restraint or authority. He was going to do what he wanted to do. His life was all about himself. And that's the kind of person that David is talking about there. He's talking about the person who thinks they can just get away with it. They can just do whatever they want to and get away with it. And that's what Solomon, I think, is talking about here as well. One who knows no restraint, who has no discipline. Not necessarily someone who's dumb, although I guess ultimately living that kind of a life is an expression of dumbness, I suppose, but not someone who doesn't have intelligence. This is not about someone who lacks intelligence. It's about someone who makes bad choices in their lives, who doesn't know discipline and restraint. To have a fool for a son brings grief. There's no joy for the father of a fool. Or Proverbs 17:25, a foolish son brings grief to his father and bitterness to the one who bore him. Or Proverbs 28:7, he who keeps the law is a discerning son, but a companion of gluttons disgraces his father. Does it matter who you hang around with? This passage happens to pick gluttons, which is to say people who let their appetites rule. Gluttons come in all sizes. There are lots of people who are not overweight who are gluttons because they are ruled by their appetites, because they are ruled by their passions. They don't know restraint. And Solomon says, you know, stay away from those people. Stay away from people who are ruled by their appetites and their desires, because they're just going to get you into a mess. But the one who keeps the law is a discerning son, one who pays attention, one who realizes what's best, and not being a companion of those who just go after indulgence. In James 3:13, who is wise and understanding? Who is wise? Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show it by his good life, by good deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. Again, the Proverbs say, this is the son that pleases the father. This is the child that pleases the mother, is the wise child. And who is wise and understanding? Well, it's the one who chooses to live well, to have a good life and deeds done for others. Good deeds, sacrifices, deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom, which stands in that passage in contrast to the wisdom that comes from below that is of the devil and is all about oneself. Proverbs 23, verses 24 and 25, the father of a righteous man has great joy. He who has a wise son delights in him. May your father and mother be glad. May she who gave you birth rejoice. And I really would share that particular blessing with everyone here, especially those who are younger and still living in their parents' homes, that the father, the parent of one who does what is righteous, has great joy. You want to honor your parents? You want to demonstrate obedience and honor? That's the way to do it, is by being righteous, by being wise, making good decisions. And this blessing, if you will, may your father and mother be glad. I would hope that for all of us to experience, to have a life that brings pleasure, that brings gladness, that brings honor to she who gave you birth. May your father and mother be glad. May she who gave you birth rejoice. Now, just a second here while I pull up the next section. In the household, there are not only parents and children, but often siblings, often brothers, sisters. Not always, but if we are part of God's family, we still have to deal with siblings in some sense in that respect. Am I my brother's keeper? Who asked that question? Cain asked that question. It's in Genesis, the fourth chapter. And this is one of those ironies that the scriptures bring to our attention without necessarily highlighting or pointing out. But God had said to Adam and Eve, if you eat the fruit of the tree in the midst of the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, what would happen? You will surely die. You will surely die. And I believe that they did die when they ate that. There was a death that they experienced there. But who was the first one to physically die as a result of what happened in the garden? Abel, their son. Okay, Abel, their son, was the first to physically die because of what they had done there in the garden, because they were separated from the tree of life, because God said, we don't want them to continue this way forever. We want to bring an end to this. This needs to be finite. It needs to be limited. Fourth chapter of Genesis, we have the story of Cain and Abel. Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain and said, I have acquired a man from the Lord. Then she bore again, this time his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. In the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat, and the Lord respected Abel and his offering. But he did not respect Cain and his offering, and Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. So the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? Why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. Now Cain talked with Abel his brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel your brother? He said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? And he said, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So now you are cursed from the earth, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. A fugitive and a vagabond you shall be on the earth. We have the story here of these two brothers and their hostility. And was their hostility, do you suppose it was a result of parental mismanagement? Was it because Adam liked one better, Eve liked one better? Was it because of anything like that? Is there any sign of that in the story? There's no sign of that in the story. There's no indication that it was anything like that as far as what happened between these two. We only have the one positive statement when Eve bore Cain. She said, I have acquired a man from the Lord, and she was pleased about that. Or with the help of God, I have gotten a man. She was very pleased about that. Did Adam and Eve have faith?
Eve did.
Well, look what she just said. Come on, I just read it in verse 1. Where did Cain come from? With the help of the Lord. Okay? I've gotten a son with the help of the Lord. I've acquired a man from the Lord. God was a participant in this process as far as she was concerned. Did Adam and Eve have faith or not? Yeah, there's no sign their faith was gone. They had sinned against God, but does that mean they had become unbelievers? They didn't become unbelievers. How could they become unbelievers? They interacted with God after the sin. All right? And I have no reason to think that they ever stopped believing in the Lord. They had erred. They had been misled. They had been seduced, as Paul kind of describes it over in 2 Corinthians. They had been seduced by the devil, by the tempter. But they were believing people. I don't know how they could have not been. I can imagine that after about the fourth or fifth generation, when there are thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people on the earth who are Adam's descendants, I can imagine that some of those people started thinking, if they knew anything about Adam at all, that he was a crackpot. Yeah, sure, you're the father of us all. You know, I can imagine that kind of thing happening over time, that it doesn't take long for people to become skeptics, for skepticism to enter in. And that may well have happened during Adam's lifetime, that there were people who thought he was a nutcase for thinking he was everybody's dad. But I don't doubt that Adam and Eve still believed in the proximity of God when they had their children. The naming process kind of says so. I've gotten a man with the help of the Lord. So there is parental faith. And then, again, when another son is born at the end of the chapter, what did Eve say? She says in verse 25 of chapter 4, she named him Seth. She bore a son. She named him Seth. For God has appointed another seed for me instead of Abel, whom Cain killed. So she's a mom who believes. She's a mom who believes in God's involvement, God's providence. She's a believer in all those respects. There is parental faith in this family. There are two men, both raised in the same family by the same parents, who have two different outlooks. And I have no idea of knowing anything at all about the parenting style. You know, I have no idea what Adam and Eve did in that regard. But there is a contrast drawn here between the kind of sacrifice that they provided. There's no suggestion in the story that God commanded this sacrifice. A lot of people believe he did. I really don't believe he did. I don't think Cain was being disobedient, but I do think he was not being generous. I don't think he was doing his best in any sense to please the Lord, and consequently, the Lord wasn't pleased. But we're told, and it's my perception that this was of their own free will, that they chose to give to God in this way. And you're welcome to disagree with that, but I think that's the case. There's a variety of reasons why I think that's the case. But at any rate, we're told what Cain did is he brought some of the fruits of the ground. He tilled the soil, he brought some of the fruit. There's nothing in the description that indicates this was anything special, that there was any great effort that went into it. He just brought something. He brought some of the fruits of the soil. With Abel, the writer really singles out, the author, the source of this really singles out, that Abel brought fat portions of some of the firstborn of his flock, which really singles out that he put some thought into this and that he used something that actually cost him. He took of the firstborn. He took of the fat portions. He presented this to the Lord. And the aftermath of that, the Lord looked with favor on what? Abel and his offering. He looked with favor on Abel and his offering. Abel, trusting God by faith, Abel, having a confidence in God, took something that was valuable to himself and presented it to God. Cain, not so much. Not so much. Not so motivated by faith. He's not listed as a man of faith, in spite of the fact that he had a brother of faith and had parents who were believers and had the view of the involvement of God. But the Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering. He didn't look with favor on Cain and his offering. Does that mean that God did anything bad to Cain? Was Cain punished for this? No, he just didn't get a good grade. He wasn't admired for what he did. He didn't get an expression of affirmation from God. In some way, Abel, it was known that Abel got an affirmation from God. He got a good job for what he did there. Cain didn't get that. He didn't get that kind of response from God. It doesn't say that God did anything negative in regard to Cain. He just didn't lift his countenance upon him. He didn't look at that and say, that was well done. And how did Cain respond when he saw that he didn't have the Lord's favor? He was angry and he was downcast. This story is really beautiful with the kind of language it uses, the descriptions of the reactions. It's really, really a beautiful story. But anyway, Cain was angry. Cain was downcast. And so God had a little consultation with Cain. He said, do what's right. If you do what's right. So apparently what Cain did wasn't what's right. He had done something that was less than right. If you do what's right, won't you be lifted up? The down and the up, these things are really very interesting in the way the language is used in the story. But if you do what's right, you'll be lifted up. And watch out, because sin is crouching at your door, and you must master it. Sin is right there. When he says that to Cain, it sounds to me like Cain hasn't sinned yet. But he's kind of thinking about it. It's kind of entered into his mind. The possibilities are brewing. Sin is crouching at your door. Have you ever, been in that kind of a position? I'm pretty sure, I suspect I'm kind of weird. I don't know. But sometimes I'll be driving down the road and an evil thought will just kind of flit through my mind. I mean, a thought of doing something horribly violent or horribly disastrous, it'll just flit through my mind. And I'm never sure. Is that because of the sin within me, or is that one of those, demonic messages that just the random broadcasting going on? We got all this Wi-Fi stuff now, and there's stuff in the air all over the place. And I'm never sure. Is that the prince of the air just kind of randomly shooting arrows and it flits through my head? And sometimes some people's head, it stops, and they act on it. Well, this thing stopped in Cain's head. Something that's never been done before. Striking down your brother. This flits and it doesn't just flit and go on by. It stops in his head. And God says sin is crouching at your door. He pictures it like a beast, like a monster, like a hungry animal. It wants to have you. You're going to be lunch if you don't make a good decision here. If you don't choose to do what's right, you're going to be consumed by this sin that is waiting to have you. Sin is crouching. You must master it. Did he master? Did it master him? And the world was changed. The world became a different place because sin mastered him rather than vice versa. And so Cain struck down his brother, and the Lord said to Cain, where is your brother? And what did Cain say? I don't know. Now, when the Lord challenged Adam and Eve in the garden, what kind of response did he get from them when he said, "What have you done and why did you do it?" Did they deny that they had done what they had done? No. Now, there was a little evasiveness, like he says, "It's her fault," you know. And she says, "It's the serpent's fault." But what just happened here when Cain says to God, "I don't know." Okay? I don't know. Did he didn't invent lying, because the devil invented lying. But he took it up. And this is kind of the way it is, you know, one sin leads to another. This is the way things work in life. This is the first recorded human lie, right after the first recorded human murder. And Jesus tied lying and murder together when he was talking to the Jews there in the 8th chapter of John about Satan being a murderer from the beginning and the father of lies. And when he lies, he's speaking his native language. Well, those kinds of things do go hand in hand. But Cain says, "I don't know." Now, who's he lying to? He's lying to God. Later on in Acts, the 5th chapter, we have a story of someone that lied to God. And what happened? They fell down dead. Well, Cain didn't fall down dead. We have God, though, speaking to Noah and his sons when they come out of the ark, and he says, from now on, okay, the from now on isn't in the story, but he says, if a man spills a man's blood, if man's blood is shed by man, what should happen? They should be put to death. God wasn't going to let this kind of thing recapitulate itself, or he didn't want it to in the time after the flood. But Cain wasn't struck down dead for lying to God, and he wasn't struck down dead for killing his brother. Instead of that, God did hold him accountable. He did chastise him. He did cause him to be a vagabond. He caused him to have a complete change of life. But Cain's question, "Am I my brother's keeper?" Give me a simple answer to that question. Am I my brother's keeper? Yes. Everyone agree with that? I am my brother's keeper. All right? That's true in the context of the family. It's true in the context of the church. We'll be talking about how those things interact, how they go together, and some of the areas where one more than the other. But the question, "Am I my brother's keeper?" Cain thought that was a clever response. I'm pretty sure he thought that was really clever. Am I my brother's keeper? I'm not responsible for him, am I? Well, in a lot of ways you are. In a lot of ways you are responsible for your brother, within the context of the family, and certainly within the context of the church. In many ways you are responsible for your brother. God says yes. And he gives us a variety of ways of seeing that, and the first one, and the one only one I'm going to look at today, is in Deuteronomy. No, not the first one, but the first one I'm going to look at is in Deuteronomy chapter 25, in verses 1 through 3. Deuteronomy 25, verses 1 through 3. This is a passage about punishment for a crime. If there is a dispute between two men, and they come to court, the judges may judge them, and if they justify the righteous and condemn the wicked, then it shall be, if the wicked man deserves to be beaten, that the judge will cause him to lie down and be beaten in his presence, according to his guilt, a certain number of blows. 40 blows he may give him, and no more, lest he should exceed this and beat him with many blows above these, and your brother be humiliated in your sight. What happened between verse 1, if two men, and verse 3, the wicked man who's being punished? What's he referred to as here in the third verse of Deuteronomy 25? Your brother, okay? This was a law of Israelites. This was a law for Israel. This was a law of the interactions of Israelites. This passage is about justice for the innocent. It's also about justice for the guilty. In the context of the family, you know, anybody have black sheep in their family? Could have. But we need to be careful in the context of the family that we don't make black sheep by, you know, I talked about favoritism before, but there's also the other side of that, where one is consistently blamed, one is consistently at fault, one is least favored, and so forth. We don't want that sort of thing to happen. God didn't want that sort of thing to happen in Israel. 40 lashes for the guilty party, but no more. Paul talked about this clear over, you know, 1400 years later in New Testament times. Paul talked about this because what had happened to him on multiple occasions? He'd been beaten with 39 lashes, 40 minus 1. Why was it 39 lashes? This is not musical math either, right? But 39 lashes instead of 40. Why was it 39? That's right. Because they took the law seriously, and the Pharisaic tradition was to build a fence around the law. And if God said 40, and maybe that first time that you didn't mean it as a stroke, but it kind of brushed across his back, maybe God counted that as a stroke, and you don't want to do 41, so only do 39, and that way you've got a little safety measure there. That wasn't exactly God's point about this. But he says 40 lashes for the guilty, and no more than that, because what do you not want to do? That's not what he says. I agree, you don't want to kill him, but that's not what he says. Let me read it again. So he won't be degraded. 40 blows he may give him, and no more, lest he should exceed this and beat him with many blows above these, and your brother be humiliated or be degraded in your sight. One of the things that happens in wartime is there's pretty much always a propaganda campaign. What's the point of a propaganda campaign? We had one. To make it easier to kill the other people. That's the point of a propaganda campaign. If you can dehumanize the enemy, it makes it a whole lot easier to shoot their people, blow up their cities, and all that. That's the way of war. You know, it's part of the process of war. And if you can't dehumanize the enemy, then you have all kinds of problems with rationalizing and being able to carry on the war. But that's a kind of a normal thing that's a part of warfare, is dehumanizing the enemy. Does God want his people dehumanizing each other? No. Does it ever happen within the family that, you know, extremely egregious and insulting things are said between brothers? Of course. Jesus actually warns about that in the Sermon on the Mount, 5th chapter of Matthew. Don't call your brother a fool. I was really careful about it. I was pretty Pharisaic. Okay, I shouldn't use past tense. But as a youngster, I understood Phariseeism very well without really knowing that I was understanding it very well. But since Jesus said, don't call your brother fool, I would never call my brother fool. Stupid, idiot, dummy. But I would never call him fool. Don't degrade your brother. Don't tear down your brother. That's a needful part of family relations. It's a needful part of relations between brothers in the family of God. Don't give more than 40 lashes, God said, because more than that, you turn him into an object. And it has been demonstrated. A lot of things have been demonstrated in tests, in, you know, psychological tests and in various environments. But when you start beating on people, it just gets easier and easier to do that. When you start abusing people, it just gets easier and easier to do that. And that's true in the context of the family, as well as in any other context in human relationships. If he is flogged more than that, your brother will be degraded in your eyes, and we don't want our brother to be degraded in our eyes. We don't want him to be reduced in rank, in rank, position, or reputation. We don't want him to be reduced in value or in quality. We want to see our brother as a brother. I'll save it for tomorrow. Our time is up, so I'll save this next tidbit on that for tomorrow. But this idea, this principle, is one I think that often gets overlooked in heated situations or in situations where we carry grudges or bitterness within the family and within the church. This is where gossip is very, very destructive, very, very harmful, is in the degrading, the tearing down of people so that you feel justified in treating them badly, so that you feel justified in putting them into a different category. You know, there's the we-us category, and there's the they-them category, and it's okay to treat they-them differently than we-us. And it's an attitude, it's a place where God did not want his people to go. And I'll resume that on Monday when we continue with being our brother's keeper and things that families ought to do together and so forth. Announcements?